In the last autumn statement of this Parliament, I present a forecast that shows the UK is the fastest growing of any major advanced economy in the world. Back then, Britain was on the brink. And today, against a difficult global backdrop, I can report higher growth, lower unemployment, falling inflation, and a deficit that is falling too. Today, a deficit that is half what we inherited. Mr. Speaker, our long-term economic plan is working. And now Britain faces a choice. Do we squander the economic security we have gained, go back to the disastrous decisions on spending and borrowing and welfare that got us into this mess, or do we finish the job and go on building the secure economy that works for everyone? I say we stay the course, we stay on course to prosperity. Today, we do not shy away from the problems that remain unresolved in the British economy. While the deficit is falling, it remains too high. So the measures I announce today are not a net giveaway, but actually tighten the public finances a little. I could have eased up on our determination to deal with our debts. I have not. And while business investment is rising strongly, we know there is still much more to do on productivity. So today we boost our skills, our exports, our science, and our infrastructure. While employment is at a record high, we must never give up on the task of finding work for all young people. So today we move further towards full employment by supporting the businesses that create jobs and apprenticeships. For decades, our economy has been too unbalanced, so we do more now to build the Northern Powerhouse. And today we back aspiration, the aspiration to save, to work, and to own your own home. It is in stark contrast to those who would hit people's pensions and jobs and homes with higher taxes, and that is an approach we entirely reject. Instead, we support people who want to work hard and get on, and it's for their sakes that we resolve to stay on course to prosperity. Now, Mr. Speaker, I turn to the report from the Office for Budget Responsibility. And let me again thank Robert Choate and his team for their hard work and for restoring integrity and independence to our country's economic forecasts. Since the budget, new international statistical standards have changed the assessment of the British economy in recent years. We now know that, contrary to claims at the time, there was no recession in this Parliament, no double dip. Indeed, the only recession was the Great Recession under the last Labour government. We also know that the economy has grown faster than previously reported, up more than 8% over this Parliament. That's the third fastest of any major advanced economy since 2010. And we know, too, that growth has been more balanced. We were told the business investment had risen by 4% over this Parliament. In fact, it has risen by 27%. Now, that's what we know about the recent past. Let's turn to the future. The warning lights are flashing over the global economy. Japan is in recession. The Eurozone is stagnating, and the geopolitical risks are rising. So I can tell the House that the OBR have revised down their forecasts for global growth this year and in every year. And they note that the slowdown is particularly acute in our main export markets, such as Europe, where growth is a full 1% lower this year than previously forecast. It makes it even more imperative that we connect British firms to the faster-growing emerging economies of Africa, Asia and South America. And today I'm providing a £45 million package to do that and to provide new support to first-time exporters. As one of the most open trading economies in the world, with a large financial sector, Britain cannot be immune to the risks in the global economy. But nor are we powerless, provided we go on working through our plan to put our own house in order. And that brings me to today's forecast. In the budget, I reported that the OBR had revised up their forecast for growth this year. A year ago, we expected GDP to grow by 2.4%. In March, we expected 2.7%. Today, the British economy is forecast to grow by 3%. Yeah. Over the last year, we have grown 2.5 times faster than Germany, over 3 times faster than the Eurozone, and over 7 times faster than France. And I think we can safely reject the advice of those in this House who told us on the steps of the Elysee Palace that we should be doing to Britain what has been done to France. In the UK next year is also forecast a little higher at 2.4%, with quarterly growth moderating as it returns to trend, then 2.2% in 2016, 2.4% the year after, then 2.3% in 2018 and 2019. And the growth we are now seeing is more balanced. Manufacturing is growing faster than any other sector, and investment is set to be up 11% this year, growing faster in the UK than any other major advanced economy. This balanced growth is creating jobs too, with a record number in work. At the budget, the OBR expected that over the last year, employment would rise by 265,000. Today I can tell the House that they doubled that number. Over the last year, 500,000 new jobs have been created. In March, they forecast that in the first 3 quarters of the year, the number claiming unemployment benefit would fall by 7%. Today, they say it actually fell by 23%. And the number of young people on long-term unemployment benefit has almost halved in the last year alone. Unemployment is revised down in every single year of the OBR forecast, falling from the 8% we inherited to 5.4% next year before settling at 5.3%. Mr. Speaker, on average, for every day this government has been in office, 1,000 new jobs have been created, 1,000 new opportunities for people, new economic security for 1,000 families every single day. Britain's long-term economic plan is working. And Mr. Speaker, in response to the caricature that some like to draw, that these jobs are being created only in London, that they're part-time with women losing out, I say look at the facts. How many of the jobs being created are full-time? 85%. Where are the jobs being created fastest right now? In Scotland and in the north of England. And what's happening to the gender pay gap? It's just fallen to its lowest level in the entire history of this country. That is progressive politics in action. Mr. Speaker, regular earnings growth is now faster than inflation. For those in full-time work for over a year, earnings grew 4% over the last year. The compositional effect of many more people finding work, particularly young people, is weighing down on overall average earnings. But the OBR today predict that meaningful real wage growth will pick up through next year and grow above inflation for the next 5 years. Indeed, I can tell the House that GDP per capita has grown faster on average in this Parliament than over the last two Parliaments combined. Yeah. Living standards are also supported by our robust monetary policy arrangements with the Bank of England. Today there is welcome news that the OBR have significantly revised down their forecast for inflation. It is expected to be down to 1.5% this year, 1.2% next year, and 1.7% the year after before it returns to target. So we have lower inflation, lower unemployment, and higher growth. Yeah. Mr. Speaker, that brings me to the forecast for debt and deficit. Now, there are those in this House who've been predicting from that dispatch box in recent weeks that I would have to announce today that the deficit was rising and the borrowing this year would be higher than last year. We discover today, I'm afraid, not for the first time, that their predictions are wrong. The deficit is falling this year and every year. And not only that, but in the final 4 years of the forecast, borrowing is actually lower than predicted in the budget. The Office for National Statistics have made revisions to the way the national accounts are measured. And Mr. Speaker, one of the advantages of having created an independent OBR is that they've ensured the figures that are presented today are comparable on a like-for-like basis with the forecast that was made in the budget. And on this revised basis, the forecast of the budget would have shown borrowing falling from the 150 billion we inherited to 99.3 billion last year, 86.4 billion this year, 68.3 billion next year, then 41.5 billion, 15.8 billion, and then a small surplus of 3.7 billion in 2018-19. Now that's the budget forecast. Today's forecast shows borrowing falling from 97.5 billion last year to 91.3 billion this year, then 75.9 billion next year, then 40.9 billion, 14.5 billion, and then a surplus of 4 billion in 2018-19. So borrowing falls every year. It falls slightly less than expected in the first 2 years, then falls slightly more than expected in the 4 years after that. So we end in a marginally stronger position than expected of the budget, and I can tell the House that by 2019-20, Britain is now predicted to have a certain...
Order, there is now excessive noise in the chamber. The Chancellor shouldn't have to shout in order to make himself heard, and to some degree he's having to do so at the moment, and that's not right. So please... The House knows the track record. I facilitate the fullest possible questioning of the Chancellor. Always have done, always will do. But colleagues, please, must give the Chancellor his head. The Chancellor of the Exchequer. Yeah. Yeah.
I can tell the House that by 2019-20, Britain is now predicted to have a surplus of £23 billion. Yeah. Out of the red and into the black, for the first time in a generation, a country that inspires confidence around the world because it seeks to live within its means. As a percentage of GDP, today the deficit is also forecast to fall this year, down by 0.6% of GDP, down from what the OBR described today in their own report as the post-war record deficit of 10.2% of GDP in 2009-10 to 5% this year. The deficit is no longer down by a third, but now cut in half. Now, it is still... It falls again to 4% next year, then 2.1%, then 0.7% before we move into surpluses of 0.2% and 1% of GDP. The structural deficit also falls and moves into surplus at the same pace over the next 5 years as forecast at the budget. We continue to meet the debt mandate a year late and the fiscal mandate 2 years early, again because of the statistical revisions and the reclassification of Network Rail, given that the side opposite tried to put it off balance sheet. The OBR have given us a like-for-like comparison on debt as a share of GDP. On the new basis, it is 80.4% this year. Next year, it peaks at 81.1%, half a percent lower than previously forecast at the budget. And it then is lower in every subsequent year at 80.7% in 2016-17, 78.8% the year after, then 76.2% again before reaching 72.8% in 2019-20. Again, this is less than was forecast at the budget. So, Mr. Speaker, borrowing is falling. The deficit is down this year to half that we inherited. Debt is falling in the same year predicted and lower in every year thereafter. A surplus that is higher and by the end of the period worth £23 billion. Britain back living within its means. Our long-term economic plan on course. Now, Mr. Speaker, the House House will want to know why the public finance numbers are much better than some were predicting, even though tax receipts have deteriorated. And the answer is, you cannot look at taxes alone. You have to look at spending too. As has been widely reported, tax receipts have not been rising as quickly as the OBR had previously predicted. By 2017-18, the OBR now forecasts revenues will be £23 billion lower. However, that is more than offset by three things. First, we're paying less in welfare and saving money on public service pensions because of lower inflation and more people in work. That saves £4 billion a year. Second, the revisions to our national accounts have slightly increased the measured rate of spending cuts in this Parliament. And we have a choice. We can either ease up or we can continue with our plans. Our policy of continuing the spending cuts in the first two full years of the next Parliament at the same pace as we achieved in this Parliament now produces £4 billion less spending. Third, and crucially, the interest we pay on our national debt is £16 billion lower in that year. That is, by a large margin, the biggest saving and demonstrates the value of our fiscal credibility around the world. Some have pointed to lower tax receipts and put forward policies for higher taxes. I prefer lower tax receipts offset by lower debt interest payments. And that is what we are seeing today. Now, Mr. Speaker, I do not hide from the House that in the coming years there are going to have to be very substantial savings in public spending. Next week we will publish a new Charter for Budget Responsibility that will reinforce our commitment to finish the job in the next Parliament, and we will ask the House to vote on it in the new year. No charter, valuable as it is, can be a substitute for the hard work of identifying real savings in the cost of government and then delivering them in practice. And that is what we've done in this Parliament, and that is what we'll have to do in the next. The work starts with our spending plans for 2015-16, which save £13.6 billion. We have published the detailed and specific departmental proposals that will achieve them. There will be two further years where decisions on this scale will be required, and as I've said before, we're going to have to go on controlling spending after those years if we want to have a surplus and keep it. Of course, people are already saying it will be impossible to achieve these level of savings. We heard exactly the same thing in 2010, often from exactly the same people. In fact, we've come in under budget every year of this Parliament. This year I can confirm that we will be spending £10 billion less than set out in our original spending plans. Now, there are those who say we should cut even faster, and those who say we should cut more slowly, but we've got the pace right, as clearly demonstrated by the fact our economy is growing faster than almost any other. And because of careful management, we can afford to put part of that underspend money into our National Health Service to cope with the pressures it faces, £2 billion every year to the front line of the National Health Service. Not money that busts our plans, but extra money available because we have a plan. And instead of returning the foreign exchange fines paid by the banks back to the city, as under the previous government, we are using that windfall for a £1.2 billion investment in GP services across the UK. That is a down payment on the NHS's own plan, providing and proving definitively for anyone in any doubt that you cannot have a strong NHS without a strong economy. I can also tell the House today that we will help with the employment of carers who do so much by extending the £2,000 employment allowance to include them. We've shown in this Parliament that we can deliver spending reductions without damaging frontline public services if we're prepared to undertake reform. Crime is down. Satisfaction with local government services is up. Savings and reform. And we will do exactly the same again, continuing to reduce departmental spending. In the first 2 years of the next Parliament would mean at least £15 billion off Whitehall budgets. Our control of public sector pay these past 4 years has delivered £12 billion of savings. By continuing to restrain public sector pay, we expect to deliver commensurate savings in the next Parliament until we have dealt with the deficit. Today, I confirm we are committing to complete the public service pension reforms proposed by Lord Hutton, bringing total savings of £1.3 billion a year. Administration costs in Whitehall are already down 40% over this Parliament. Today, my right honourable friend, the Minister for the Cabinet Office, is publishing a plan for a further £10 billion of efficiencies. And I'm also confident that in the next Parliament, we can continue to crack down on tax avoidance, evasion and aggressive tax planning. Doing so at the same rate as in this Parliament would raise at least another £5 billion. And today I commit to deliver that. And then there's the new welfare cap we've introduced to control the one-sixth of public spending that was subject to absolutely no control at all. The OBR Today report that the government is on track to meet the welfare cap commitment. Today we undertake further steps to control benefit spending by freezing universal credit work allowances for a further year, cutting tax credits when overpayments are certain, and ending unemployment benefits for migrants with no prospect of work. Total welfare spending is now set to be £1 billion a year lower than forecast of the budget and will go on falling as a share of our GDP. And as I've made clear, I believe we need to freeze working age benefits for 2 years, saving billions more. Now, decisions to control public spending are never easy, but the impact on people's lives when economic stability is lost is far, far greater. And I've always believed we should be straight about what's required to restore stability and what's required to stay on course. Now, Mr. Speaker, our task is made easier by the deal we secured for this country when we got the European Union budget cut. Some people claim that our payments to the European Union would go up this year. Instead, I can confirm that the OBR's forecast today shows Britain net payments to the EU falling by around £1 billion for this year and the next year, and falling in real terms over the next 5 years. That is the dividend we receive thanks to a Prime Minister who fights hard for our national financial interests in Brussels. Mr. Speaker, another bill that has gone down is the cost of our overseas military operations. The end of our operations in Afghanistan allow us to save an additional £200 million this year from the Special Military Reserve. I join with the rest of the House in saluting the brave men and women of our armed services who for more than a decade have risked their lives for our security in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And of course, even as we speak, they are tackling the horrific Ebola virus in West Africa, a fight that reminds us all of the value of Britain's commitment to 0.7% in development aid. And today I am extending our inheritance tax exemption to cover our aid workers who lose their lives in dealing with humanitarian emergencies. LIBOR fines will continue to support our military and emergency service charities with support for our armed services benevolent charities, the Gurkhas, and £10 million for veterans with hearing problems. We'll make sure the First World War continues to be properly commemorated. And this morning I announced we will repay our entire outstanding national debt incurred to fight the First World War. We will extend the Cathedral Renovation Fund to cover repairs to our country's churches. And thanks to the brilliant campaigns run by my honourable friends for Filton, Bristol North West and others, we will use the LIBOR money for new helicopters for the Great Western Air Ambulance and the Kent, Surrey and Sussex Air Ambulance too. And I will go further and refund VAT for our search and rescue and air ambulance organisations across the UK. Our hospice charities also make an enormous contribution to our communities. They have long been subject to unfair rules that force them to pay VAT when the NHS does not. I am today refunding the VAT that these hospice charities incur. Mr. Speaker, I turn now from those who have paid too much tax to some of those who have paid too little. First, we will make sure that big multinational businesses pay their fair share. Some of the largest companies in the world, including those in the tech sector, use elaborate structures to avoid paying taxes. Today, I am introducing a 25% tax on profits generated by multinationals from economic activity here in the UK, which they then artificially shift out of the country. That's not not fair to other British firms. It's not fair to the British people either. Today we're putting a stop to it. My message is consistent and clear. Low taxes, but low taxes that will be paid. Britain has led the world on this agenda, and we do so again today. Mr. Speaker, this new diverted profits tax will raise over £1 billion over the next 5 years. Second, I'm taking action today to make sure that our banks pay their fair share too. Under the rules we inherited, banks can offset all their losses from the financial crisis against tax on profits for years to come. Some banks wouldn't be paying tax for 15 or 20 years. That's totally unacceptable. The banks got public support in the crisis, and they should now support the public in the recovery. I am today limiting the amount of profit in established banks that can be offset by losses carried forward to 50% and delaying relief on bad debts. Together, that means banks will contribute almost £4 billion more in tax over the next 5 years. We will also put in place internationally recognised measures on hybrids and reporting of tax by country. That's multinationals and banks paying their fair share. So should people aggressively trying to avoid their tax. That's the third step. I'm taking measures to prevent the disguising of fee income by investment managers, the avoidance of tax through special purpose share schemes, miscellaneous losses and payments of benefits in lieu of salary, the avoidance of stamp duty on takeovers, and unfair benefits for the transfer of some intangible assets on incorporation. These measures and others set out in the document raised £2.8 billion. We're also consulting on other measures, including the use of so-called umbrella companies to deprive people of basic employment rights like the minimum wage and as a result avoid tax. Fourth, I want to preserve the non-dom status that makes our country attractive, but I want them to pay a fair contribution while having certainty about their future arrangements. In the next Parliament, the £30,000 annual charge will remain unchanged, but those who have been here for 12 of the last 14 years will see their payment rise to £60,000, and I'm introducing a new £90,000 charge for those resident in this country for 17 of the past 20 years. And to tackle the continued use of envelope properties to avoid stamp duty, I'm increasing the new annual charge by 50% above inflation on properties worth over £2 million. All of these tax measures I've announced amount to £9 billion over the next 5 years. And the distributional analysis the Treasury publishes today shows that the decisions across this Parliament mean that the rich are making the biggest contribution to deficit reduction. In fact, the net contribution of the richest 20% will be larger than the remaining 80% put together, proving that we are all in this together. Yeah. Mr. Speaker, we will make further reductions in government spending and welfare, and we'll make sure taxes are paid. But ultimately, our future living standards depend on Britain earning its way in the world, so we must increase our productivity. And today we take steps to back business, support science, and invest in infrastructure. This government has succeeded in making Britain the most entrepreneurial economy in Europe, and today we want to go further. To make sure our growing smaller businesses have access to credit, we will expand the British Business Bank and act to encourage peer-to-peer lending. And with the Governor of the Bank of England, I am extending the funding for lending scheme by a further year and focusing exclusively on smaller firms. We'll strengthen entrepreneurs' relief and the social investment tax relief. We'll accept almost all the recommendations of the Office of Tax Simplification to reduce the administrative burden on firms, and I want to thank Michael Jack and John Whiting for their work. Our tax breaks have ushered in, Mr. Speaker, a golden age for Britain's creative industries as well. Today we will extend our new theatre tax break to orchestras, and we will help... And we will help one area of television production that has been in decline with a new children's television credit alongside our new animation credit. I know, Mr. Speaker, the whole House has been saddened to hear that Wallace and Gromit may no longer be produced because the man behind Wallace's voice has retired. But after next May, I'm sure the whole House will unite behind a suitable and by then available candidate. Mr. Speaker, Mr. Speaker. We also want to help British business do more research and development. This is crucial to our productivity. Today, I'm increasing the R&D tax credit for small and medium companies to 230% and the credit for larger firms to 11%. This government has repeatedly helped small business deal with the burden of business rates. We do so again today. We will double small business rate relief for yet another year. Now, the last government were going to close this, but it benefits 500,000 firms, means 250,000 firms pay no rates, and we're going to continue to fund it. I will also continue to cap the inflation-linked increase in business rates at 2%, and I'm announcing a full review of the structure of business rates, and I urge business groups to engage with us on that. Last year, to help our high street shops, pubs and cafes, I introduced a new £1,000 discount on their rates. With the brilliant Small Business Saturday this weekend, I'm increasing that help for the high street by 50% to £1,500 next year. Mr. Speaker, the fall in the global oil price has meant a welcome boost to much of the British economy and to families. There is record investment this year in the North Sea, but the lower oil price clearly presents a challenge to this vital industry. My right honourable friend, the Chief Secretary, will set out our full proposals in Aberdeen tomorrow, but I can tell the House today that we will go ahead with an immediate reduction in the rate of the supplementary charge from 32% to 30%. We'll expand the ring-fenced expenditure supplement from 6 to 10 years, and we're introducing with immediate effect a new cluster area allowance. And this demonstrates our commitment to the tens of thousands of jobs that depend on this great British industry. But despite falling fuel prices, let me make this absolutely clear. We've cut fuel duty and we will keep it frozen. Yeah. Mr. Speaker, with my old friend Vahalo sitting right behind me, I wouldn't dare do anything else. And just as we demand that falls in oil prices should be passed on to people at the pumps, other fuel price surcharges should also come down. We're going to require airlines to list the charges separately from the taxes on tickets. But I also want to reduce the cost of those tickets for families directly. My right honourable friend for Altrincham and my honourable friend for Leicestershire North West and many others have asked me to help reduce air passenger duty for children on economy flights. So from the 1st of May next year, air passenger duty for children under 12 will be abolished. And I will go further than they asked. From the following year, we'll get rid of APD for children under 16 altogether. Now, Mr. Speaker, improving productivity for all businesses also demands a major investment in our nation's infrastructure. Because we've controlled our day-to-day spending, I can confirm that we'll invest more as a share of our GDP over this Parliament and the next than was achieved under the whole period of the last Labour government. This week, we've set out plans for the biggest road-building programme for a generation. We've committed billions to our flood defences, and today I take forward the recommendation of my honourable friend for Waveney and expand tax relief on business investment in those flood defences too. It's all brought together in the National Infrastructure Plan that is now helping our country attract more investment from around the world than any other single country in Europe. Mr. Speaker, Britain is raising its ambition, and nowhere is that clearer than in our commitment to science. It is a personal priority of mine as Chancellor. Scientific advance is a human endeavour worthy of support in its own right, but it's also crucial to our economic future. When we came to office, the UK was ranked 14th in the Global Innovation Index. Today, we are ranked 2nd, but we aim to be the best. A year ago, I abolished the arbitrary cap on the total number of undergraduates at our university. Today, I'm going to revolutionise the support for our postgraduate students too. Until now, there has been almost no financial support available, and the upfront costs of postgraduate degrees deter bright students from poorer backgrounds. So today, across all disciplines, we will make government-backed student loans of up to £10,000 available for the first time ever to all young people undertaking postgrad master's degrees. Yeah. Mr. Speaker, the next step is the allocation of the £6 billion on the biggest ever sustained programme of investment in the research facilities of our scientific community. This includes money for major new scientific challenges, from the search for advanced materials to groundbreaking work on ageing to the exploration of the universe. The Rosetta mission to the comet captured the nation's imagination. I can tell the House that yesterday Britain was awarded the lead role in the next international effort to explore the planet of Mars. Mr. Speaker, we on this side of the House... Well, Mr. Speaker, we on this side of the House have often gazed at the barren and desolate wastelands of the red planet. And we've long given up hope of finding intelligent life there. But signs of any life at all would be a major advance. Now, Mr. Speaker, many of the new science investments will be made in the north of England. But one of the great challenges of this country is to create a more balanced national economy, a challenge that has eluded governments for generations. Our ambition is to build a northern powerhouse as a complement to the strength of our capital city, where we bring together our great cities of the north. And since I set out that ambition less than 6 months ago, we have proposed, reported on, and given the green light to the concept of High Speed 3. This week we commit billions of pounds to other road and rail improvements across the whole of the north of England. I can today confirm that we will tender for new franchises for the Northern Rail and Trans-Pennine Express, replacing the ancient and unpopular Pacer carriages with new and modern trains. When I set out the ingredients of a northern powerhouse, I promised to address this. Today I deliver. And a few months ago, there were no proposals for major scientific institutions in the north of England. Today we commit a massive £250 million investment in a new Sir Henry Royce Institute for Advanced Material Science in Manchester, with branches in Leeds, Liverpool and Sheffield. And we back the brilliant work on ageing being conducted at Newcastle University and big data computing at Hartree. We're also committing to the industry of the north with investment in new high-value manufacturing research. We're supporting new academy schools there too. And we're announcing a new sovereign wealth fund for the north of England so that shale gas resources of the north are used to invest in the future of the north. The cultural life of the north will get a boost too, including a major new theatre space in Manchester. Manchester City Council proposed to call it the Factory Manchester, and anyone who's a child of the 80s will think that's a great idea. Yeah. And Mr. Speaker, 6 months ago people would have said it was completely impossible to get the 10 local authorities of Greater Manchester to come together with the government to agree a major devolution of power to the city and the creation of a new directly elected mayor. We've delivered in Manchester, and my daughter is open to other cities who want to follow their cross-party lead. I said I'd put the Northern Powerhouse at the heart of this autumn statement, and with billions of investment in science, transport and new civic power in our great northern cities, that is exactly what we have done this week. We show today what can be achieved if you have the determination and ambition to deliver a truly national recovery. Mr. Speaker, we will also respect and fully implement the devolution settlements across the nations of our United Kingdom. Today I announce that we recognise the strongly held arguments for devolving corporation tax setting powers to Northern Ireland. The Treasury believes it can be implemented provided the Northern Ireland Executive can show that it is able to manage the financial implications. The current talks will see if that's the case, and if it is, the Government will introduce legislation in this Parliament. In Wales, we are working towards a cross-party agreement on further powers for next March. I confirm today that we have reached agreement with the Welsh Government on the full devolution of business rates. This is a great opportunity to grow the Welsh economy. The Government last week supported the proposals of Lord Smith's Commission on Scotland. These will lead to the devolution of income tax rates and thresholds and other powers, and ensure the Scottish Government is responsible not just for spending money, but for raising the taxes to pay for it. We will publish the draft clauses in the new year. The sheer scale of devolution to Scotland now makes the case for English votes for English laws unanswerable. Mr. Speaker, To improve the productivity of our economy, we back business and we build infrastructure, and we will support growth across the whole UK. But in the end, Britain's future lies in the hands of its people and their aspirations, the aspiration to save, to work and to buy a home. And today we support each one. First, saving. From next April, we will trust people with control over their own pensions. In this autumn statement, I confirm that the 55% death tax that currently applies when you pass an unused pension pot onto your loved ones will be abolished. Yeah. People will be able to pass on their pensions to their loved ones tax-free. Yeah. I can also tell the House today that we will ensure that people who die before the age of 75 with a joint life or guaranteed term annuity can pass that on tax-free too. Yeah. Next week we will publish the market-leading rates on our new 65-plus pensioner bonds, which will be available from January. Our £15,000 new ISAs are hugely popular with savers too. Next April, we'll increase the limit to £15,240. But Mr. Speaker, we'll do something more. At the moment, when someone dies, the savings in their ISA lose their tax-free status and their spouse starts paying tax on that money. From today, I can announce that when someone dies, their husband or wife will be able to inherit their ISA and keep its tax-free status. Pass on your ISA tax-free, pass on your pension tax-free. We are delivering fairness for savers. And we're delivering fairness for those who aspire to work too. The number of young people on unemployment benefits has halved. Our goal is to abolish youth unemployment altogether. To support businesses who take young people on, we are already from next April abolishing national insurance contributions for employing anyone under the age of 21. Today I can go further. Under this government, almost 2 million people have taken up an apprenticeship. And the Prime Minister has set this country an ambition of 3 million apprentices in the next Parliament. So we back the business to employ apprentices, especially young apprentices under the age of 25. At the moment, we charge national insurance on businesses who employ apprentices. Today, I can announce that the jobs tax on young apprentices will be abolished altogether. When a business is giving a young person a chance in life, we're going to support them, not tax them. Mr. Speaker, we also back people of all ages in work, and that is why this government has raised the tax-free personal allowance to £10,000. Next year, the tax-free personal allowance, which was set to rise to £10,500, will rise instead to £10,600. So that's a total wage boost for working people of £825 a year. It means 3.5 million of the lowest paid will now be taken out of tax altogether, because we on this side of the House don't sneer at people who want to work hard and get on. Mr. Speaker, I just thought I'd flag that up. Now, it is the first step to the new goal we have. It is the first goal to the new goal we have set of raising the personal allowance to £12,500 so that people working full-time on the minimum wage pay no tax at all. Today I can also announce that unlike previous increases in the personal allowance threshold, this increase will be passed on in full to higher rate taxpayers paying 40%. So the higher rate threshold goes from £41,865 this year to £42,385 next year. This is the first increase in the higher threshold in line with inflation for 5 years, and this year's increase means 138,000 fewer people will pay the higher rate than would otherwise be the case, and it is a down payment on our commitment to raise the higher rate threshold to £50,000 by the end of the decade. Mr. Speaker, there are those who have said it was impossible to control public spending, improve public services, reduce the deficit and still cut income taxes for hard-working families on low and middle incomes. Today we have settled that argument. It is possible and we're doing it, provided you have a long-term economic plan that you hold to. Mr. Speaker, I turn to my final measure. As well as the aspiration to work and to save, there is the aspiration to own your own home. Today I am announcing a complete reform of a tax that has been described as one of our worst designed and most damaging taxes of all. Stamp duty is charged at a single slab rate on the whole purchase price of a home. It means big jumps in tax when house values tip into a new band. The distortions can be particularly damaging at the lower end. If you buy a property worth £250,000, you pay £2,500 in tax. Buy a house worth just £1 more and you pay over £7,500, that is three times as much. And in recent years, the burden of stamp duty has increased on low and middle income families trying to buy a new home as prices have risen. This makes it even more difficult to get together the cash deposits that buyers need. It's time we fundamentally change this badly designed tax on aspiration. So I am today abolishing the residential slab system altogether. In future, each rate will only apply to the part of the property price that falls within that band, like income tax. And here are the new marginal rates. You will pay no tax on the first £125,000 paid, then 2% on the portion up to £250,000, then 5% up to £925,000, then 10% up to £1.5 million, then 12% on everything over that. As a result, stamp duty will be cut for the 98% of home buyers who pay it. If you buy an averagely priced house of £275,000, you will pay £4,500 less in tax. The average home in London will see a similar reduction. As I say, 98% pay less, and the whole reform represents a tax cut of £800 million per year. Only homes that cost just over £937,000 will see their stamp duty bill go up under this system, gradually to start with, rising to more substantial sums for the most expensive homes. A £5 million house will see its stamp duty rise from £350,000 to £514,000. But of course, this is a charge that is only paid once when the property is bought. I can tell the House that these changes to stamp duty become effective from midnight tonight. Anyone who has exchanged contracts but not completed by midnight will be able to choose whether to pay under the old system or the new, so no one in the middle of moving house will lose out. The changes will apply in Scotland until the Scottish Government's new regime comes into effect next April. At the end of this statement, I will move a motion to introduce this. There will be a debate tomorrow and legislation will follow. Mr. Speaker, there has been a debate in this country about taxing houses. The system I introduced today replaces a badly designed system that has distorted our housing market for decades. It reduces stamp taxes for 98% of people who pay them in this country. It increases the taxes on the most expensive 2% of homes, but only asks people to pay that tax when they buy the house and they have the money. And it does not involve a revaluation of hundreds of thousands of homes in this country. Today, I'm cutting stamp duty for millions of home buyers in this country, 98% better off. It is a fair, workable, lasting reform to the taxation of housing, and it is in stark contrast to the shambles of an anti-aspirational, unworkable homes tax that the party opposite want to impose. Mr. Speaker, 4.5 years ago, our economy was in crisis. People questioned whether Britain could remain among the front rank economic nations of the world. But we set a course to restore stability, get on top of our debts, and show Britain was not going to be counted out. Through the storm, we have stayed the course. Now Britain is on course for surplus, on course for lower taxes, on course for more jobs, on course for higher growth, on course for a truly national recovery, a long-term economic plan on course to prosperity.